And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are, just moments, days, really, before the summer solstice to gather our wits. You know, and it is a deep and powerful, complex time. We'll be being joined at the half hour by Ann Manning, who returns after a brief last week's show to speak to us about money and the economy and the work of the Robin Hood tax and many things that we can do. So, yes, so first, we are here to gather resilience in the heart of complexity and difficulty, and to honor grief also, from which seeds of new life arise. So first, I just thought I'd play a favorite, a short thing from Kamu Daoud from his CD, Limert Park. There's only one line that I would change. You'll know what it is when you hear it, but it's pretty great. So here's that.
The nectar of scholars pondering the universe into music infants understand. Let us see the world that clearly. Let us know the world that well. It's a matter of believing, beyond believing, knowing. It's a matter of seeing the future materialize as we see it. It's a matter of organizing the raw matters of life into images as we will them, not wish them to be. It's a matter of motion, a matter of discipline and sweat, a matter of developing the human potentials in ourselves and others. As we organize our space, we organize our life. As we organize our space, we organize our life. The motion is the music. The energy is the music. The constant change is the music. The struggle is the music. Blowing, glowing, grooving, moving, expressions, impressions, pointing to a higher place. Break the silly staleness, the loud farts, the sound pollution, the lies. Bust the rat's eardrums. If you can't sing.
So we can all hum. I don't want to bust the rat's eardrums, though. We are kin with all beings. But what a great and rousing going, right, that might be in the astro-mythological language, the voice of the Saturn within us. We remember at these points of seasonal change that, you know, for 25,000-30,000 years that we know of for sure, humans have understood that deliberate celebration of the change of seasons stirs the creative powers of the psyche. And it is always, again, this realm of the moving from the sun in Gemini to Cancer, you know, the zodiac, the circle of life, the circle of animals, as a metaphor to direct our attention, going, now we honor the power of language. Today is Sun at the very last degrees of Gemini, right next to Mercury, Messenger, retrograde, let us remember what gets us through. Its image, there are images for each degree of the zodiac, is the first mockingbird of spring. And as a wise gardening ally said, the mockingbird, that's the bird that knows all the languages. And then part of the beautiful exhortational woof before us of encouragement when so much of what passes for news is like, oh, no, and certainly the retrograde going, no, not the repeat. No, what's Dick Cheney doing there again? Oh, my God, move that into Pluto's cauldron backstage. So much hangs in the balance, but it is to all of us. And, you know, these moments also are that we all, you know, insource what we've been outsourcing. So part of the theme for this summer, the astro-mythological theme, which has nothing to do with belief, it's like the art of directing attention. So from Gemini it says, then we move to Cancer, the summer solstice beginning, you know, on June 21st this year. It is also Elizabeth Warren's birthday. She is born exactly on the summer solstice with her son right next to Uranus, the trickster, the principle of democracy and equality. And we go, ah, in the mystery play, what a good being she is, to tease, you know, sane, reverent common sense and reverence for life into public policy. Yes, what a good idea, our teammate in the mystery play. So part of the dynamic of this beautiful ancient language is that the sun would illuminate the kind of presiding imagery as it moved from sign to sign. And on summer solstice, it moves from Gemini, ideas, into Cancer, the realm of cultivation and the deep mysteries of birth. And the word culture, which we know, if we look up in a good dictionary, you know, the first three, four definitions are, what do we grow? What do we grow? And then way down the list, by analogy, is human culture as a metaphor for what do we encourage the growing of? What crops, outwardly, literally, and inwardly, what shall we encourage? What qualities? So part of the beautiful dynamic of now is that the Sun and Mercury quintile, a 72-degree angle, which is sacred to Venus. It's what we get, you know, Venus forms, when we divide the circle by five, we get 72-degree angle. Venus forms a five-petaled orbital design over 8 years, which is why in the corresponding lessons, as above, so below, all five-petaled plants were sacred to Venus. One of her names is Isis. We'll come to that. And then also the five-act structure of storytelling is thought of as intrinsic to nature. And those who've been hanging with me for a long time know what here it is. We're going to repeat things because it's good to repeat, especially now. So the model of storytelling and how can we all be effective storytellers for the emergent culture, you know, of sane, reverent common sense and desirability and be voices for that. We're gathering our language skills, and then it moves into the realm of Cancer. What do we plant? And the whole realm of economy. Economia, you know, came really from the women's province of tending the garden, the pantry, the all of that, the running of the household, and then the wisdom of running a household teased into how do we run a larger household, but upon those same principles that everyone's doing so well. There we go. So as we move from, you know, Gemini to Cancer, what seeds do we want to plant, you know, and seeds of a new and ancient economy. And that's why at the half hour we'll be being joined by wonderful, jaunty Ann Manning, you know, who will describe, you know, practical things that the Women's Congress for Future Generations will lay forth for free on their calls. And they're also going to be having, you know, a study manual that she will present to us on how do we do these things? How do we form a new economy, you know, when so much is daunting? You know, from Gar Alpowitz, in an interview, somebody says, you say that the shift to a new economy needs to start with ourselves. What advice would you give to people? And he says, there's an enormous literature about what to do. If you're serious about this, you need to form a study group and read some of this stuff and find out what people are doing all over the world and work out what's best for your circumstances. If they can do it in many cities, why can't we? All of a sudden, it changes the responsibility from nothing can be done to what can we do here. I mean, one of his main themes always is, rather than blaming people, what shall we do? And we go, right, let's shift our focus, or as, again, Camus Daoud says, you know, organize ourselves and encourage each as well. What gets us through this, you know, our pluck? So we're going to weave music in a moment as well from Irish Jig. I'll be presenting a summer solstice talk, summer solstice setting sail for synchronous serendip, Isis, rah, rah, rah. That will be in Washington, D.C., Sunday, June 22nd at 7 p.m., At the Institute for Spiritual Development, the information is at coyotenetworknews.com. But with me will be wonderful Irish musicians, Lilt, who are so jaunty. Again, What Gets Us Through. In a moment, we'll be hearing one of their rousing tunes, you know, from Ireland, from the Middle East. These are cultures that know great sorrow and from which beauty blooms. And that's part of the medicine that we want, going, oh, those who've experienced great loss. You know, we have many stories to present this hour also of resilience that we want to admire, people who've suffered greatly and who emerge going, oh, it's like in New Orleans, all the second line parades, they begin with the musicians coming out of the funeral homes. Oh, New Orleans is so witty and profound that way. And the last time I was there, you know, the musicians, again, these large, handsome black guys were wearing T-shirts that said, "We Heart Haters." And I go, oh, that is so New Orleans. That is so admirable. So Dargar Alperovitz continues, things always start in small groups, right, like a family. The question is not only about changing systems, but how we engage existentially ourselves. It's about looking in the mirror and saying, am I up for this? If we're seriously interested in transforming the most powerful corporate capitalist system in the world, if you want to play this game, then chips are decades of your life. You don't have to play, but if you want to play, you need to throw a few decades of your life on the table. Go, oh, thank you. Thank you. Our, you know, miraculous resilience, you know, comes to us from many realms. There's a BBC story of June 19th, just now, Christian family refusing to give up its Bethlehem Hill farm. A Palestinian Christian family that preaches nonviolence from a farm in the West Bank is battling to hold on to the land that it has owned for 98 years. Now surrounded by Israeli settlements, the family's a living example of the idea of peaceful resistance. See, also at this time, again, culture, wisdom, land, tending, you know, all of these qualities, the qualities it takes to care for a grove of trees. And as we'll see in this article, you know, to care for the grove of trees, and even when it is unjustly and unfairly destroyed for no good reason at all, to come back with the powerful phrase, I will plant more trees. We will not be tempted into violence or hatred. We will plant more trees. And we go, ha. So again, in this article, it says, on the 19th of May, you know, a Palestinian shepherd from the village of Nahalin was out at first light and saw the bulldozer at work in the field. By the time Nasser, the owner of the land, arrived, the entire orchard, a decade's work, was gone. His English is far from fluent, but there's no mistaking the pain in his voice. Why you broke the trees? A spokesman for the Israeli military authorities in the West Bank said, well, the trees were planted illegally on state land. It has become state land in the last year. We go, oh, so Nasser's sister Amal has a different explanation. The government, together with the Israeli settlers who live around the farm, is trying to push us to violence or push us to leave. Amal insists that her family will not move from the land, nor will they abandon their commitment to peaceful resistance. Nobody can force us to hate, she says. We refuse to be enemies. We refuse to have enemies. That phrase, which is painted on a stone at the entrance to the farm, was first used by her father, Bishara Nasser, long before the concept became widely known among Palestinians. He taught his children a theory of nonviolence that was rooted in his own Christian beliefs. Bishara means gospel. Nasser was a child when his father bought this land in 1916. Even at that time, as World War I transformed the Middle East and the Ottoman Empire limped to an end, Palestinian Christians were beginning to emigrate. After the war of 1948, the Christian exodus from the West Bank quickened, and Bishara, who was a gifted preacher and accordionist, began to travel around the nearby villages, singing songs, leading Bible study in family homes. Music and stories, he thought, might deepen the faith and lift the spirits of Bethlehem's Christian children, encouraging them to stay. Bishara also came to believe that the Christian community had a special role to play in building a more peaceful future. One of the things we want to also, include, you know, part of our dynamic, all of us teammates, you know, is what is this quality of syncretism? It is a most welcome quality. And it comes to us, you know, everywhere, you know, since the last week, you know, there's been the weird, trippy quoting of ISIS as the, you know, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, but it was like ISIS. Does ISIS pose a threat? You know, is ISIS or whatever? And we go, well, ISIS was, you know, many things. I'm dusting off all my esoteric texts. I'll be presenting more on ISIS just because her name slipped into public conversation. And now, of course, they're changing it to ISIL or the Levant, you know. But nonetheless, the Mythic News says, you know, it is a happenstance, a slip of the tongue, perhaps, and certainly not consciously intentional by Hyper Yang, death frenzy, boys destroying everything. But nonetheless, it is the antidote, because the originating impulse behind ISIS is that she is nature herself, presiding over, you know, births and difficult births and the deaths that happen at birth. You know, reminding us that all life, it's not easy to get here, that all life deserves respect. So this syncretism also is, you know, where we say let all mythic figures be understood as, you know, metaphoric animations of intrinsic intelligence in nature. So they morph and they shapeshift. Isis Osiris mysteries come from Egypt. Much has been written. I will be reporting on more of it in the Mythic News through the summer, and also at the Trickster Training Council I'll be giving at Hollyhock. But, you know, for our purposes now, we just sort of distill this, going, okay, nature, the image for all embracing nature, and that resilience which gets us through the joy of successful birth, of an animal, a creature, a human baby, a project, a community, and it's also the strength that gets us through the death of those things. And syncretism, you know, can be best understood also as how things morph and shape. We say, you know, qualities of intelligence and mythology want to dance together in harmony and in accord, but very often they're only given Hyper Yang Mars death frenzy. War is a way to integrate, but there's poetry and beauty and art. So, you know, it's many years ago that I just remember thinking, ah, the Jamaican people, Jamaican culture, Jamaican accent, I love it so much. I could hear that lilt. Oh, I could hear that lilt forever. And what it reminds me of, Irish lilt. I go, oh, I could hear it, something in the melody. And then, you know, it was years later in Michael Ventura's great essay on the voodoo roots of jazz and rock and roll that I read that in the 1660s, Oliver Cromwell's brother in charge of Ireland sold thousands of pagan Irish women and babies into slavery into the Caribbean, where, again, there are people from many great African civilizations being forced into slavery and from different cultures. And so they're syncretizing. The Celtic women bring the maypole and Celtic magic. The different African civilization cultures, you know, bring Django. Christianity arrives, and the attitude of syncretism is absolutely embrace everything to come up with a common working way of increasing our intimacy and our capacity to collaborate with nature and with each other under enormous pressure and grief. You know, we want that cross-pollinating resilience from different cultures and different qualities. So that's also Santeria in its most beautiful true form, which is behind every, you know, every Christian saint is an African deity. So behind Santa Barbara is Django. And we go, right. But it is that quality, as we distill things to their essence and decide what we want to cultivate in ourselves this time, we go, well, this attitude of syncretism, yes, borrowing, not, well, including, inviting, being willing to dance. We say magic, let magic be understood as simply a willingness to cooperate with everything. So it is quirky and wonderful, you know, that ISIS has, you know, has returned to be quoted in the news in a toxic form, reminding us of the tonic antidote that she represents. You know, the main themes that we know, the crisis of the world, you know, as we head in ever more deeply in this powerful summer, is that dominance and control and the death frenzy, which is so outrageous and relentless in so many myriad sociopathic forms, you know, is like, ah, yeah, but we go, but empire, colonialism, dominance is collapsing along with infrastructure, but taking so much life with it, which is why we need also the art form of grieving, and the art form of grieving as a deepening dedication to life that comes out of grief, as this beautiful Palestinian family gives expression to. So we go, oh, we like that. So So syncretism, again, a willingness to dance, going, yes, we like this from here, and yes, and this wants to dance with this, all of these qualities in that Isis kind of way. Again, the story of the Nassars, Bishar Nassar's father had registered his property owned for 98 years with the Palestinian new imperial rulers in 1924, and he still has that deed, the official copy of the 1924 land deeds. They've raised the money to take this to the lawsuit, to whatever, but again, never being tempted, well, we're all tempted, but never giving in to violence or enemy, going, ooh, and I go, ah. So miraculous resistance. We know that so many themes, again, Middle East, also in the Middle East, you know, movement and the great temple builders, you know, in Malta and Sicily, and then moving up into England and Stonehenge, and then into Ireland, and we're going to play just a jaunty reel called Launching the Boat from my allies Lilt, with whom I'll be performing, presenting on Sunday in Washington, D.C. But it reminds us of, yes, the quality of pluck that, you know, comes out of sorrow. And so here we go. We just need a little pluck to carry with us across the border into summer. That's launching the boat from my colleagues Lilt, again, wonderful Irish musicians from many places, from America and Germany, because we are all global people, again, syncretized people, drawing resilience. What gets us through? Who brought what to this party? You know, and we're just sort of tracking, again, the mythological and musical themes of resilience that move through, that have everything to do also with economy. Economy is culture. Again, what do we cultivate? What do we encourage? You know, it's the cross-partisan conversation with deep conservatives that is possible, in which they say, you know, well, what about, you know, the work of, oh, I'm forgetting the name of this important conservative writer. It'll come back to me. Oh, okay, there it is. What do you know about this work? And I said, not much. And they go, well, this person's idea, the name will come back to me, is that this conversation about small government, big government is irrelevant. That it is, again, what this important famous writer said, the more we cultivate inward responsibility to common well-being, the few outer laws and regulations we need. And we go, yes, this is a worthy conversation. Edmund Burke, thank you. Thank you, Mind, for surfacing. It's the writer Edmund Burke that has been embraced as a kind of darling of the conservatives, going, great, the more we cultivate, and we're entering into this deep cultivation, what do we want to cultivate ourselves, our families? The more we cultivate, you know, again, deep dedication to the common good, the fewer outer laws and regulations we need. However, we have these sociopathic dementors, you know, that we do want regulations and guiding for corporations. What is the conversation we want to have about economy that we'll be conducting in the second half of this show after the break? What is the purpose of government? We want to have these smart conversations. Remember that in the 1930s, you know, in this country, Emma Goldman and, you know, Alexander Berkman and the smart people were giving talks to packed, you know, small community theaters in Baltimore and Cincinnati and Oakland and everywhere, in which people were turning out to converse passionately about, you know, what's the role of government? What's the role of community? How shall we govern? What's the nature of economy? How shall we do these things? What about, you know, ownership? What about worker ownership? I mean, passionately engaged, and then it's slowly kind of gone to sleep. But as part of our storytelling skill and, you know, and segueing from ISIS in the Middle East and back and forth, because, you know, well, that's what we're doing right now. But, you know, the jauntiness that comes of, say, the Irish jig that of resilience, it reminds us of Frank McCourt, whose beautiful memoir, Angela's Ashes, he wrote in his 60s, won the National Book Award. And it was so heartening to hear that he said he had to rewrite the narrative voice three times, because the tale is heartbreaking, heartbreaking about deep sadness and grief and loss and, you know, alcoholic, irresponsible, you know, violent fathers. And it's a difficult narrative. And he said the first time he wrote it, the narrator's voice was too bitter. It was unreadable. It was too sad. It was too bitter. So he had to find what our ally David Grimes called the innocent dignity of his child heart, the savvy participant observer but never jaded heart, the innocent dignity of our child heart. And that's the narrator, and that's what made this such a brilliant book. And that's also part of the dynamic of the summer solstice. It is the opportunity for the innocent dignity of our child heart to be reborn, born again. You know, again, with all of the grief and the sorrow and the outrage and the injustice and all of those things, nonetheless. You know, again, it's often said that the Palestinians or the Irish of the Middle East, there is a great kinship of culture and beauty and, you know, all of that. We go, yes, kinned, cross-pollinating to and fro. And how are each one of us cross-pollinating agents, you know, between to and fro? What do we love? What do we have an affinity for? And it is part of what we've been bringing up over the last years. This model of, you know, what is the fundamental shift that we want? If dominance is going down and collaborate with nature's ingenuity, you know, is rising up in a renaissance, you know, how do we become effective voices and agents for that? We wonder, not belittling the enormity, the against all odds part of it all, which is why we want our plucky trickster selves to rise up from this rubble. But we do honor our lives as spiritual detective novels, meaning everything for which we have an affinity, everything we love, whether it's a culture, it's a poem, it's an animal, it's a plant, it's a province of the world, it's the Arctic, it's whatever it is that we love, we are its ambassador, we are its agents of intimacy, we are engaged in being representatives of that in the court of the human world. Again, the importance of voting and things that we'll get to everything in the fullness of time, of course, but we do say that, and we go, again, whatever we love is a clue to be honored, and that is also the realm of this transformation that wants to take place, that is already in some stories, simultaneous stories taking place, of let all kind of sociopathic hyper-yang death frenzy be replaced with Venus, beauty, art, the mythology underneath that. Inanna lives in Iraq. What does that represent? These are not la-la-la beautiful. These are forces of nature, fierce beauty that brings us into intimacy. So we're going to take a very short break now, is our attitude, come usual. And we will be, Ann Manning will be joining us after the break, and we will continue our dedicated cavort.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Off and down.
Shiny, 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 come blow my shiny horn. Ooh, shiny, 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 come blow my shiny horn. Grab my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, yes, and we are wonderfully, wonderfully grateful and lucky to have Ann Manning rejoining us right now for the second half of the hour. Her website is wealthforthecommongood.org. She is Initiative Director for the Women's Congress for Future Generations, and here to give us some grounding and facts. We've been wafting around, waiting for you as well. Ann Manning, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, that's great. So, we started with a wonderful Camus Daoud piece, kind of organize ourselves. What should we do? And how do we gather that wolf? And, and then the wonderful Gar Alperovitz going, well, you got to put a couple decades in.
I loved that.
Well, yeah. And then we
it's
went
so
to,
true.
And then we went to Palestine to, incredible family that, their land of 90 years is their beautiful orchards have been bulldozed, but they refuse to have an enemy. They go, we will plant more trees. And then I was just looking at the 1960s and the excellent reporting coming out right now on the Freedom Riders and that quality of dedication. Like, whoa, my goodness, these people going to Mississippi and putting, secular and religious and the unity of purpose and putting their lives on the line. We go, that's dedication. And then I love also your dedication, and we were going to cavort back into Economia, the actual things that we can you can derive from Gar Alperovitz, and also the Robin Hood tax, which I just want to keep animating, and how people can find out more about that, and what a good creative idea, even though it's got a lot of, against all odds quality here. So Robin Hood tax, how might we see that happening? Can you present it to our team again?
Yes, the Robin Hood tax is legally known as the financial transactions tax.
Yes.
And it's an idea that has been around a while. It's getting a lot more traction in Europe. And so given how global our markets are, it could be that as it gets implemented over there, it does, that then it will eventually have to come here just to keep world trade in balance. But it's really about just saying, particularly it would affect those who trade a lot. And it would be a very, very small, far less than 1% tax on every trade. And over time, that adds up to billions of dollars to put back into the economy. And we are losing so much through what many refer to as the Wall Street casino that really belongs to the commons, that belongs to society, so that we have, you know, good infrastructure. How old is our electric grid? How old are our water systems? How do we move into 21st century transportation? Anyone who travels overseas sees that most of our airports are nowhere near 21st century, nowhere near. And so this is the kind of revenue stream that could begin to put money back into creating a really healthy United States.
It's so appealing because everything, you know, as I said to you about, you know, hedgehog funds, and I want you to, you can come back and explain how we can get intimate with money as opposed to, whoa. But the Robin Hood bill, you sent me the great YouTube video, and there are many, Bill HRC 6411, you know, Representative Keith Ellison, may he be praised forever, the Inclusive Prosperity Act, would raise $350 billion, well, up to three in annual revenues, with a 0.5% tax on trading transactions. We go. So when I brought this up to grown up hedge fund people, sometimes they invite me to their houses, which I have to say, well, welcoming their hospitality and not meaning to be grumpy, but it is, you know, Watergate, all glass and steel, postmodern. The houses of the super wealthy are just as abstract as the money that made that.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
And you go, woo, and you know, and. Yeah. You're not touching nature. We were going ISIS, right. ISIS being quoted, ISIS basically is the goddess of nature, and we're on the brink of the summer solstice, which is what do we cultivate and what do we encourage, and economy and Elizabeth Warren, and now you're here to help animate all these things too. So when I brought it up, see, I need my inner Ann Manning, because when I brought it up to actual hedge fund managers, she goes, no, of course it wouldn't possibly work, because, you know, because then banks will just keep raising the rag, and then my mind glazes over going, okay. So what is the grown up hedge fund response, and how can we get around that?
Well, one story that I just feel compelled to tell is my colleague at Wealth for the Common Good, Chuck Collins, was in a march in D.C. for the Robin Hood tax one day, and he was marching with a woman, and turns out they're both from the Boston area, and he said, you know, what in the world are you as a nurse coming to Washington, D.C. to advocate for a financial tax? And she said, because we see the damage showing up in our clinics every day. People without jobs, without health care. We are creating a third world economy. The haves and the don't haves are getting pretty darn spread out. Where I don't know about you, but in my circle, I have many friends who are fine and going to be fine financially. But there are a lot of my friends who feel like they are in the boat of the great sinking middle class. People who 10 years ago felt like they had a solid foothold economically no longer feel that way. And they're scrambling. And so this is the kind of tax that, A, you get the money into Washington. If we could start applying it where we need to really become a green, sustainable economy, there are plenty of jobs for everyone that could be. And as people work, they pay more taxes. So the coffers continue to support healthy education, healthy health care. So we're at a tipping point now where we have to really create the political will to say we have pulled too much money out of government in this privatization mode. And it's time now. I just read an article that all the soaring corporate profits, are you familiar with the fact that Wall Street, of course, is going way up because corporate profits are up? And I'd need to get the reference, but I believe it said something like 2/3 of the real increase in corporate profits is due to the fact that they are paying so much less tax. Right. About 1/3 is due to productivity and market gains. It's really about paying less tax.
And just as a slipping in right there, John Nichols had an interesting take on Eric Cantor being overturned by Mr. Brett in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was saying, oh, immigration. He goes, no, actually, immigration reform was pretty popular when you polled everybody. What people mostly said is that Eric Cantor was too much in bed with Wall Street and wore handmade shoes with lifts in them. And we go, there's a common conversation again.
Exactly. That's where we can reach out and across lines and really find some common ground that too many, you know, fortunately I'm represented by Keith Ellison, so I feel pretty darn good about that, you know, and Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar, but too many of our politicians in Washington are very wedded to Wall Street on both sides of the aisle.
Absolutely.
And so we really have to find a way to intervene. And it's going to take a groundswell. It's what Gar is saying. We all have to give a decade or two. And for me right now, the heart of my work is with the Women's Congress, and our website is futurefirst.us, futurefirst.us. And at the Congress here, the National Conference here in November in the Twin Cities, Rhian Eisler will be here from Chalice and the Blade, and her recent work is really about the real wealth of nations, creating a caring economy. So how do we build an economy that values everyone and who protects the earth? And we have to get there. We have to begin to build that bridge, because right now the divide is becoming so big that I can't remember if it was in Gar or someone else's article that said, we know now that it's the people who are going to have to do the work. It's not going to be done from Washington. It's going to be led from here. And so one of the things that we have to do is begin to say, what is it we value and how do we measure that? And I can't remember if I said this last week, but Rhian's work says, if we pollute the Gulf with an oil spill, GDP goes up because we're paying lawyers and cleanup crews. And so it looks like the economy is growing. Well, that should not be a positive sign of a growing economy. That should be a negative sign of a growing economy. When my niece decides to stay home and take care of her own child and quits teaching and quits paying a babysitter, the economy shrinks because she's doing what her heart says she needs to do. We aren't measuring the outcomes that really produce what I think we all want, which is a healthy society of people who are cared for and a planet who is cared for.
Yeah, and that's again what Elizabeth Warren gives is the part of ourselves that gives such great voice to. And her birthday on June 22nd, Sun Uranus conjunction, incarnation of the fiercely democratic, you know, moon really going and teasing that. And then, you know, again, these conversations of which we're all a part that want to happen and then to result in ways in which you are guiding, because you said the Women's Congress is going to come out with a kind of manual for, you know, conversations about, you know, shaping a new economy, that, you know, a 6-week kind of course that's handed out to people for free to sit around with your neighbors. And do you want to speak to that? Yeah,
we just we're just in the process of sorting this out and just had a 2-hour conversation about it today. You were there at the first Congress where we drafted the Declaration of Rights for Future Generations and Responsibilities of Present Generations around the ecological issues and environmental issues of the day. And we only had a few economic principles. So one of them that's in the current declaration is no debt to future generations without a corresponding asset. So if we are buying the boundary waters of the Grand Canyon, that's great. But if we're funding wars in Iraq, not a good idea. So what we're thinking we're going to do is claim a few key principles, but not many, 3 to 5, and then craft. So your listeners, we invite you to send us your ideas. We want to animate questions. That's a commons word that my friends in the commons work, Caroline Rapsisberger, Julie Ristow, Anamika. How do we animate the questions about what are the big questions around the economy? How do we create a system that works for everyone? Is there such a thing as full employment anymore? Or is it really, do we just have the technology where most of us really only need to work 4 to 5, 6 hours a day if we structure the economy in a way that allowed it to work that way?
Right.
I think that's actually possible.
Yeah. If we could overcome, Yahweh conditioning, the grumpy God.
Yes.
Right. And I would think that one of those, over and over again, it's like, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance so many years ago was saying, let's, price and cost. Evil shenanigans gets away with itself because there is no price on polluting.
There's no price. Exactly. And that's another core principle. Polluter pays. And
right.
That just has to be a core economic principle.
And it's also cost versus price, which is crucial because, again, what your work and the Institute's work mm-hmm. and all that is that, the simple example, the cost of putting, rock salt on the highways to melt snow
mm-hmm.
is cheap. The price is exorbitant in terms of pollution of water and, destruction of infrastructure and, on and on and on. But so once we give a price, it liberates imagination
mm-hmm.
because for half of that, for a quarter of that price, what you could do? You could have, people would not have to work and, except for 3 days a week and they could commute. I mean, so the imagination gets liberated going, cost versus price. Okay, that's right. So polluter, it's again, precautionary principle, first do no harm. Polluter pays I don't know if you got, there was a great interview Chris Hayes did with Elon Musk, head of Tesla, which is doing interesting things. They're selling batteries mm-hmm. to other companies because they want electric cars to do well everywhere. It's kind of like a larger version of Judy Wicks in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
Turning all restaurants onto her suppliers because she wants all restaurants to get better. And people are like,
exactly.
But those are your competitors. And she's like, no, we want to all rise together.
Yes.
Yeah. So
that's the worldview shift that we're all trying to work towards, isn't it? I mean, I think that you've just stated it very well. We're all trying to be better. And I think Judy Wicks has really put that into practice.
Yeah.
In a way, most of us are still a little reluctant to do, but that open sharing and saying, the old Wellstone line, we all get better when better.
Well, apparently it's the Tesla thing, aspiration. And in this way, we do have, may it be a summer of, empathic kinship that we're all in this thing together and that, altruism is part of the evolutionary dynamic that was,
mm-hmm.
left out of, Darwin science because it's like, what about altruism?
Mm-hmm.
But so Elon Musk was, intriguing because he was saying, because he's going, the sheer size of replacing the trillions of dollars invested in fossil fuel structure that, he said, we got to do it, but it's, the size is enormous, the vast amount of infrastructure that needs, completely, not only just the bridges and everything that need redoing, but the re-gearing, and that's when he said...
It's daunting. I agree.
Well, but he said that the main impediment is because there is no price on polluting, and that's why fishermen
that's
fish
right.
to extinction... Because the death of fish has no price.
It's so true.
So we want rewards for dedicated ingenuity for collective good, really, right?
Mm-hmm. That is just exactly right. We do not have the systems in place that penalize deeply behaviors that are both destroying the planet and creating lives that are, many people who are destitute. A friend just was at a seminar this week where they said 80% of the population of the globe live on less than $10 a day. I mean, that's stunning.
That's
a stunning statistic. And I don't know if you've heard this, but in our generation, I'm 66 years old, since World War II, so pretty much my lifespan, we have used more of the planet's resources than in all of time. So we cannot keep going. That's completely unsustainable. And as Joanna Macy would say, how do we become the beloved ancestors? How do we wake up to the fact that, I'm calling on a lot of names here, but, Winona LaDuc said a couple weeks ago, hey, we've all had a pretty darn good party on fossil fuels. We've got to admit it. It's been a pretty good life. But now we know. We know better. We maybe didn't. We do now. And so how do we move? How do we all wake up? How do we all get that consciousness that GAR is calling us to have? This is going to take a couple decades of deep work on all of our parts. And if you feel called to do it, there are many places to do it.
pour forth a few. Again, people can find out about these resources at your website or at futurefirst.us or the wealthforthecommongood.org.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a New Economy Working Group.
Excellent. Okay.
Is that .org, I think.
Probably. Mm-hmm. New Economy Working Group. Many people, the slow money movement, because where I got heartened, and because in the more mythological realm, and Janine Benyus, wonderful founder of biomimicry, encourages me to take all scientific facts and understand them as metaphors, because, we go, all right, vertical integrated hierarchy, it means everything in nature contains the plan of the larger thing it's a part of.
Yeah.
So when she said this is what makes for nature's ingenuity, resilience, and self-assembling. So by analogy, as we come to these moments, seasonal change, whatever within our hearts, where we make our dedications, it strengthens our signal. So we're more likely to be self-assembled, into the larger dynamic. But so there's that. But there was also an economist years ago on the show who just pointed out what we all know, which is all of our metaphors for money are all water.
Yes.
Currency, cash flow, liquidity, drowning in red ink, rising tide. So I had to say.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Well, it's very important. It's for kind of mythological mystics like me. I go, this could be heartening if we can understand it intimately. So I asked him to play it out, going, okay, there's pipelines going through neighborhoods, and he goes, the problem is most of the pipelines with money, waters of life, they're sucking out of the community with external ownership of businesses and liquor stores and sports stadiums. And so what we want to do is poke holes in that pipeline. Again, that's the slow money, to have it circulate.
Yeah.
How many times does a dollar circulate in a community before it leaves? So the permaculture principles applied to economy
are critical.
Critical.
And
beautiful.
Yes, and beautiful. When you really start to study that, it's really amazing. That's those worldview shifts that we're all trying to get right now. And that's what these study guides will be coming out of the Women's Congress, will be ways to help people go home and create just exactly what Gar's saying, is get your book group and study group together. And so we're going to have tools with some of the key principles and topics. If we can, get the resources, we'd have short videos that would unpack key concepts. And then we could arrange for speakers. If there's a community issue that people really want to talk about, we can arrange for Skyping in key experts on different arenas. So we have big aspirations about how to help build these conversations, the new narrative, to begin to build that bridge to a new future, a new way of being. It's going to take all of us and a lot of creative thinking.
And in a way, in the kind of infinite game or that we all want to keep playing, but to understand the to and fro, so Obama postponed the decision on the XL pipeline for 6 months. And, even Bill McKibben was like, oh, no, another delay. And I'm like, no, are you crazy? This is important. Every delay is good. Mm-hmm. Many, many great women environmental activists and, slow it down. But then, ball in our court, all of us, to come up with the guiding coherent story with economic grown-up terms like you can do, to feed to him and the world, going, and here's what we're doing, here's the guiding story, here's the way it works, and here's how it works economically, and by the way, we're not going to do that pipeline because there we go. We've got these, 5 months, 4 months? I mean, we've got forever to do this, but in a way of kind of the organizational incentive to come up with coherence and to connect all these different pieces of wisdom and action and things that are going on, the public banks and Boulder utilities are municipally owned, and the pluralist commonwealth and all those things. Because that's the idea of going, okay, and here's how it works economically, and here's how it works culturally, and here's this vision. I love Gar saying, to move in a positive direction, we need to give people something to do rather than someone to blame. We go,
yes, that's exactly. That's, I think, Mary Pfeiffer from Nebraska. Do you remember her book, Reviving Ophelia? And she's deep into the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska and other environmental issues around the country. And she'll be at the Women's Congress. Her new book is called, it's not that new anymore, The Green Book, Reviving a Capsized Culture. And she speaks to how that despair, even if we don't feel the despair, we just think we're numbed out, really has such an impact on our culture of people who don't want to give this a couple of decades. But as you link arms and begin doing the work, your energy level just rises and you get excited about what's happening, all the good things that are happening and all the great ideas that are out there and coalescing and doing exactly, I think what you are just so eloquent about, Caroline, is just how do we cahoot to get these ideas launched on the planet, give them traction, bring them into form, because they are floating in the atmosphere right now, and it's up to us to grab them and move them forward. And that's, I think, what's so inspiring about the work that's being done right now.
Yes, absolutely. And then I was just just something that I don't know, I just want to put in, even though into our brew, because of the inadvertent mention of ISIS, as a bad thing, but has had me, dusting off my books on ISIS, going, ISIS is, one of the syncretized, original ISIS and Horus. I mean, and the Magic Flute is inspired by the description of the mysteries of ISIS and Osiris. Yeah, Mozart's Magic Flute is inspired by a description of the mysteries of ISIS and Osiris in the Latin novel by Apuleius, The Golden Ass.
Oh my goodness.
No, it's everywhere. And it's all about love and everything. But a lot of mm-hmm. her also is, there's the Black Isis, which is related to Kali, because it's called the Breaker of Pieces. There's a part of Isis, this is the Breaker of Pieces, that sets mm-hmm. people free, that is about deep grief, mm-hmm. and about, emerging more resilient from pain. And I just wanted to shout out, I've been recovering from dental surgery, and so quite inward until right now. And it's nice to not talk. But I did read this gigantic book that has left, it's haunted me. It's called a novel called The Story of Edgar Sawtell by David Wroblewski. And it was compelling, so powerful about dogs, and not sentimental, powerful, and humans, and the whole connection, and about loss. And it had one of the great moments also in which the woman loses her baby. It's a stillbirth. And she talks about loss and the beloved, the tree, the child, the dog, the pup, the baby that does not live, leaves a space in our heart that does not vanish. And she says it's a dark black seed that is a sacred place for that being that did not live. And it's like, ooh, and it permeates the book. But I go, well, that's kind of ISIS, and that's why I was playing the jaunty Irish tune before you got here, going, the dark black seed of ISIS is also the honoring of, the loss and the Palestinian family that loses its, decades-old, orchards. And we go, it's a black seed. It's not a bitter seed. It's a place of grief that is then dedicated to life. And in that way, I just wanted to bring in that complexity, because we're entering, Sun Enters Cancer, which is Big Mama. Big Mama says, come on home. And that's the kind of shift that takes place. Again, about all the things that you're describing and telling us about. And here we are. Okay, so there's many things that you want to, put forward. That's good. That people can find out about at the website. And then right now, let me grant you the remaining 90 seconds. We'll have to do our own conference, Anne, at some point.
We will.
Yeah, that would be really good. So no debt without corresponding assets. Conservatives will like that until they get into it more, but that's a good conversation. Animate the cost versus price. Yay, Winona LaDuke. Anything else you want to put on our work table right now? The seeds of the new economy for this summer.
I think we are in a waking up mode. I really believe that people are. I was at a gathering last night to talk about the Future First Women's Congress. And what I see when we talk about the state of the planet and where we are, and that we need to withdraw our consent. And that's where I think we really have power. And then to be able to say, and here are the principles and values that we consent to. And how do we work together to articulate those, to figure out the traction? How do you get the how-tos? How do you make them alive? I think bolder, privatizing, or publicizing, you know, our words are all screwed up, right?
That's right. But they're now commonly held, and we're done all too soon. But let's keep our conversational cahooting going. Absolutely.
Yes.
And I like withdrawing our consent and withdrawing our complicity. And those are also, and then exhaling it into the desirable. But yes, on and on. Thank you so much, Ann Manning. And,
thank you.
Again, the Women's Congress, you can find out more at, your website, for Future Congress.
FutureFirst.us.
Thank you, FutureFirst.us. Okay, thanks so much to Alex.
Bye-bye.
I'm getting your last name. Yeah, Drawinskas, thank you. In D.C. and to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. We will reconvene next week. Thank you all so much.
Bravo for Women in the Arts and Black Artists Contemporary Cultural Experience present the Bay Area premiere of Zakiya Alexander's Sweet Melody, running June 17th through August 3rd in a benefit for the Bravo Theater Center. Set during Reconstruction, Sweet Melodies follows the story of three recently emancipated sisters and their former mistress as they contemplate a future in a post-slavery America. Based on Jean Genet's The Maids, Sweet Melodies features the work of critically acclaimed actors Britt Frazier, Kehinde Koyejo, Stephanie Martin, and Lisa Ann Porter. Sweet Melodies runs June 17th through August 3rd at Bravo Theater Center, 24th in York in San Francisco, and it is wheelchair accessible. Visit www.bravo.org for tickets and information. That's